Coming up today, gig economy showdowns, paleo paintings, and clever corvids. You're listening to episode 326 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hi.
A thing you learned this week, Matt Burgess.
I learned this week that in Pennsylvania, there is the world's biggest house in the shape of a shoe.
Wow.
This is great.
It's about 7 metres tall. And 15 metres long. I don't know what size it is in actual shoe sizes, but I imagine it's pretty big.
Yeah.
Like a giant shoe.
What maybe. Kind of shoe are we talking?
I'm not really good with types of shoes. It's more like a boot, but I don't really know what you would call it. It was made by like a shoe company as a promotional thing, but people do actually live in it, which is cool.
Yeah, I guess.
Unless like the giant that is puts its foot in it has athlete's foot.
Or just puts its foot in it at all, because you'd all be crushed to death.
I don't know why I was trying to make a joke.
No.
It really didn't work.
Yeah, let's move on. Vicky Turk, save us. What did you learn this week?
Oh, I've got a really good little feel-good fact. So this week, something happened in nature which has never been witnessed before. A lioness called Nosikitok in Tanzania was witnessed nursing a baby leopard. So this is the first time that a big cat has been seen nursing a cub from another species.
Go nature.
Yeah, isn't that cute?
And adorable.
It's lovely.
Your fact's more adorable than Matt Burgess's chew fact.
It might not remain adorable, because there is some question as to whether her pride will accept this leopard cub.
I imagine they'll have to be separated, or maybe just let nature take its course.
I think they're going to let nature take its course. So fingers crossed for Nosikitok and her little leopard cub.
You can't imagine it's going to be a Disney ending. Something tells me it's not going to be a Disney ending.
Well, you know, maybe I can update people next week.
Can't wait. Can't wait to find out about a dead baby cheetah. I found out that when lightning hits you, the reason that people often report that their clothes exploded off their body isn't directly because of the lightning. It's because of their sweat. Or normally because when there's lightning coming down, it's raining as well. So any water on the body instantly boils and explodes, which makes your clothes literally explode off your body. So if you were completely dry, you'd be all right. But obviously people tend to have at least a little bit of perspiration. So
I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't realise that people reported their clothes exploding off them when they were struck by lightning.
Yeah, there's a really, really fascinating article that The Guardian published from the Wellcome Trust, some researchers there, who have been looking at the effects of lightning strikes on survivors for decades. And they've collected lots of items. So people tend to keep the clothes that they were wearing when they were struck by lightning, and all of them look a little bit exploded.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of cool, but also kind of terrifying. Our first story this week is one that I haven't quite got my head around yet. So, Matt, I'm hoping you can explain it terribly well. The Taylor Report into the gig economy.
So, absolutely no pressure then?
No pressure at all.
Okay, so as you mentioned, the Taylor Report, or the Taylor Review, as some people have called it, was published this week. It was and is a 7-month-long look at working practices in the UK. So it covers loads of stuff around how people work, the working conditions, the laws, the regulations. And one of the big parts of this report is about the gig economy, which is something that people who work for the likes of Uber, Deliveroo,
TaskRabbit,
companies like that, those sorts of companies. And this was only one section of the report. It wasn't all of it, but it was obviously an important part for us covering the companies that work in this sort of space.
Yeah, so let's stay focused on the gig economy, because there's an awful lot of lobbying going on around this. The government's under a lot of pressure to update legislation, both from the companies who would call themselves gig economy companies, but also for people who are fulfilling gig economy jobs. So they've got a big job to do getting this right.
Yeah, and as a little bit of a rewind, a catch up for people who aren't that familiar with the gig economy, it is a very complicated thing, and so are all the working practices and regulations in the UK generally around the laws around this, because there are a lot of different definitions of what an employee is, what a worker is, whether you're self-employed, and we'll come on to that a bit later. But in the gig economy, generally people get paid for completing services and tasks based on one-off occasions. So you get in an Uber, that counts as a job, that person gets paid for all that through their company. And that's pretty much how the gig economy works. People obviously say that workers can be exploited because they may not be paid as much, or they may not have the same rights as other people, but the companies who run these sorts of things often say that they offer workers more flexible. They're there for when people want to work, and in theory you could do one job a day if you wanted. You could do one Uber delivery run, you could do one delivery of food. Yeah. And that's the sort of theory behind it. Obviously, it doesn't quite work out that way because work and people need money, and it's very complicated, and you can't just really do one thing that you're not getting paid a lot for. So yeah. It's a pretty controversial and also very much still developing area in terms of the law and practices and everything. And this review was really to look at how these companies work, and particularly within the UK and the UK's laws, because every country in the world has different setups for these types of companies.
So before we get into a little bit of a debate, because I can tell everyone has opinions on this, what did the Taylor review suggest?
So the big thing for people in the gig economy is that those people in the job should be classed as dependent contractors. This is a slightly redefined and slightly new definition of what a gig economy worker is. And basically, a dependent contractor, the review was saying, is between somebody who is sort of fully employed and self-employed. So it's a halfway house, really. Though that these people are allowed to work for these companies, but they're not directly employees, and neither are they self-employed. So right. It's just really in that gap between.
But it's adding regulation where there currently isn't regulation. This is the idea.
But this is just a recommendation, right? It's not actually regulation yet.
That is something we should obviously make very clear, that this review was independent from government. It is something that is not actually doesn't go straight into law. The government agrees with a lot of the things in here because it's worked probably fairly closely with this, because it was tied into Theresa May's big campaign relaunch. So it is still, all the things that are in here have to be passed into laws, and there will be debate in them in government, and there may be amendments and different ideas when the actual sort of legislation comes out. But if this dependent contractor status is introduced, it will effectively mean that employees of these companies should get more rights as if they were employees.
So things like sick pay and holiday.
Yes. So the basic things that most people who are in a salary job, well, everybody who's in a salary job expects. And I think one of the big things from this report was saying that it's actually workers should be given their statutory rights on day one in plain English. And to directly quote it, it says, ultimately, if it looks and feels like employment, it should have the status and protection of employment.
Now, this is a really, really interesting and important point. The plain English part, I think it was The Guardian that got hold of some internal documents from Deliveroo, and it was how Deliveroo was using legalese and using very complex language to define its relationship with its couriers. And I couldn't understand it. Lord knows who could understand it, but you definitely need a fairly well-qualified lawyer to go through and define exactly what they're doing. So, regardless of where you sit on either side of how these workers should be classified, everyone needs to be clear about exactly how they're classified.
Exactly. And one of the actual recommendations or points that the review said should happen is it recommended introducing an online portal where everybody in the country had their working status clearly displayed. Like, obviously, that's probably unrealistic in terms of creating something of that scale and holding data and blah, blah, blah. But it's just trying to redefine and let people know what position they're in, whether they're working for a company full-time or whether they are a dependent contractor or an employee or a worker or a volunteer or a voluntary worker. There's so many different classifications under employment law.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where regulation really needs to keep pace with technology, and it's been rapidly outpaced in this area. So the union reaction to this report has been not great.
No, not really, which I think is probably not surprising, given obviously unions are there to fight for greater rights for workers. So the British Trade Unions Congress said that introducing a new category of dependent contractor will actually make things more complicated because it's another piece of bureaucratic definition and stuff in there. And it was also saying that these companies they think got off fairly lightly from this review, because there was no, within the document, it didn't recommend introducing a ban on 0 hours contracts, for example, which is something that gig economy companies can do in some cases.
So it lets them dive out the way of paying a minimum wage because they're not technically an employee. You're still not giving them those same rights. But the courts, to an extent, are on the side of the workers.
Yeah, there was a court ruling, I think it was either early this year or end of last year, where a few Uber employees took the company to court.
They're not employees, Matt.
No, they're technically, the court said they are workers, and they should get a basic set of human rights under the law, including minimum wage, minimum level of paid holiday, rest breaks, no working time more than 48 hours a week, which is pretty standard in the employment laws. So the courts have sort of come down on the side of workers and people who are doing these jobs. And I know Uber's appealing that case, but I think there's also other ones out there against Deliveroo and other companies in this country. So it's a developing area. And as you say, it's something that has had to happen because regulations and laws can't keep up with innovative startups and companies that are changing how we work.
And I was thinking of, we read a very good explainer that you can read on wire.co.uk going over exactly what the gig economy is. But something occurred to me. Well, this isn't actually a new thing. It's merely the scale that it's operating at that is new. We've had people that are working sort of cash in hand, the odd job here and there. So you get paid for cleaning an apartment. You'll get paid for doing someone's laundry. And it's all very unstable. And it depends just how much you're able to cram into your day. You don't have a salary. You don't have any kind of stability. So all that Uber and Deliveroo and TaskRabbit have managed to do is add a technology layer on top of it, and in some ways become even less accountable for the people under their pay. So now you have this problem that it's operating at such huge scale that you really, really need to regulate against it. This isn't just something that's happening in back doorways and in shady deals. These are some of the world's most valuable companies. In the case of Uber, one of the world's most valuable, and Deliveroo, I think, has a chance of being one of the UK's most valuable startups. So it's a big issue to tackle.
Yeah, and obviously we have like conventional freelancing, so things like freelance writers or artists and so on, but you know, and I think the report kind of points this out, that these gig economy companies that use technological platforms, they feel different, they work differently, there are different things at risk for people who take on this work. So it's a really tricky area. And yeah, now that this review is suggesting they're not workers, they're not employees, they're dependent contractors, whatever that might mean, I'm not convinced that clears up the issue too much for anyone, really.
No. And so something else I found very enlightening this week, we got in touch with a Deliveroo courier who wrote us a fascinating op-ed on his experience of working as a courier in Brighton. For years now he's been doing this, and he lays out a very rational, reasoned argument for what him and his fellow Deliveroo workers are looking for and why it's important for them. So I'd encourage people to go and read that as well, to get a different perspective and try and sort of empathize with people that are struggling in a variety of ways. Our second story, as always on the podcast, a slight change of pace, dinosaurs and dinosaur art.
Not just dinosaurs as well, all kinds of prehistoric creatures and scenes.
Why are we talking about prehistoric creatures and scenes?
So I wrote a story on wire.co.uk this week about paleo art, which is the art of visually depicting the prehistoric world, and yes, most commonly dinosaurs. So I spoke to an author called Zoe Liskays, I think that's how pronounce her name, sorry Zoe if I've got that wrong, and she's written this new book from Tashin, which is all about paleo art, and it kind of traces the history of this art form from the 1830s when it first started to about the 1990s.
It kind of goes without saying that we don't have any photographs of dinosaurs, so
exactly
ever since the art of depicting them started, as you say, in the 1830s, there's been lots of different approaches.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So first of all, obviously, these artists are working closely with the fossil record, with whatever scientific evidence they have of prehistory. And so when they started out, they had a lot less of that. It was just around the time that people were starting to actually understand what fossils were, that these were kind of remnants of ancient creatures. And they might just have, you know, one bone from a dinosaur. So they had a lot of artistic license, and they had to use their imaginations quite a lot to bring these scenes to life. And so One example Zoe told me about, which I really love, is a paleontologist called Gideon Mantell, whose wife, Marianne Mantell, discovered some giant teeth, a fossil giant tooth. And he realized that this looked very close to the tooth of an iguana that we have around today. But that was all that he had to go on. And so he simply took the tooth and proportionately grew an iguana shape.
Until we had a giant iguana.
Until we had Iguanodon, which is Iguanodon, still a dinosaur we know today. So this thing he imagined was sort of 18 meters long. We now think it was about half that size.
Still fairly terrifying.
Still fairly terrifying. Still a bit iguana-like. So this is just sort of an example of how people had to take what they had and sort of extrapolate from that.
So in some ways, to go back to the 1830s, people had a very, very small idea of what dinosaurs were actually like, as you say, going on very little evidence. But the way that they depicted the dinosaurs, and go and have a look at some of the pictures in Vicky's story, they're really, really cool. The way they depicted them is stuck around. Mm-hmm. So those misconceptions are still how dinosaurs are depicted in Jurassic Park. And when the BBC did that big Walking with Dinosaurs series that I think really captured an awful lot of people's imagination around the world.
Yeah, I mean, things get updated all the time. But it is really interesting how, you know, one discovery of one bone could essentially kind of render a bunch of paleo art obsolete. So one example of that is someone discovered that dinosaurs would hold their tails up when they walk because of the bone structure they had there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And previously they were always depicted dragging them along in the ground behind them.
Why would you do that?
Well, exactly.
That's mad.
If you don't know that, then that's what you probably imagine.
There's also some interesting stuff that you found out about the background in dinosaur pictures.
Yeah, and just kind of the whole way that they're depicted. So as well as being sort of a scientific art form, I suppose, it is also, you know, art. And so there's lots of different ways that you can show things.
They're never doing mundane things, dinosaurs
no.
in pictures, are they?
All having a cup of tea.
Paleo art is just like a dinosaur ripping into another one, tearing its neck off, like wildly throwing it around in the air. It's never just like, yeah, just wandering along, sitting down.
That's definitely a favoured form. Although you're wrong, sometimes they do have more placid scenes. Yeah. And this is really interesting. So you can kind of see schools of art in paleo art. So you can see a very famous paleo artist called Charles Knight often looks quite impressionist in his work with, you know, the colour palette and the obvious brush strokes and so on. And then you have sort of romantic era paleo art, which focuses on the sublime, which are these dramatic scenes of bloodshed and volcanoes exploding and the kind of thing you're thinking of, Matt.
And even though it was a very long time ago, I think it's safe to say that there weren't volcanoes exploding constantly. They lived in a fairly stable world until it all came crashing down around their ears.
Anything for a dramatic narrative.
I suppose, yeah, as you say, it is art.
Exactly. And one of the things I found super interesting that Zoe told me was that, you know, in some of these more placid looking scenes, the dinosaurs are kind of presented as presiding over the landscape. And she draws a link there with imperial iconography and suggests that, you know, this was the height of the British Empire. And those cultural influences, like any art form, are being captured in these images.
So artists with an imperial mindset, if they were British, were drawing and painting in an imperial way,
possibly, it was dinosaurs
rather than the Queen.
Possibly. We can only, you know, look back in hindsight and draw these interpretations. But, you know, these things can seep into culture quite, you know, with quite
easily
far-reaching tendrils.
Yeah. I remember when I think the most recent Jurassic Park film came out, I think we did a story in Wired in the culture section about how dinosaurs are depicted and the work that had been done on the film. And broadly, paleontologists were quite encouraged with the leap from the original Jurassic Park to the most recent one. But what they said was still missing was you can't persuade anyone to put feathers on a dinosaur. And yeah, we now believe that they were mostly feathered creatures.
Yeah, so obviously nowadays we know a lot more than we ever did about dinosaurs, and we will hopefully continue to do so. There are still paleo artists working today. It's still a very vibrant scene, and often, you know, if you see a scientific paper that's sort of discovered a new dinosaur, you will see images to go with it that have been made by a paleo artist. And yes, that we do know a lot more about, you know, pigments and feathers. There's a lot less room for artists to sort of experiment and put their own kind of imagination to work, although it's still obviously a necessary tool. And one of the reasons that Zoe decided to stop her book in the 1990s was because she said, you know, there's a marked shift in the way that paleo art is approached. And nowadays people are going for a very naturalistic, almost photorealistic look. So the images look more like something from Blue Planet or other nature documentaries rather than, you know, a classical artwork.
I eagerly await the Hollywood blockbuster that dares to put feathers on dinosaurs. Because all of a sudden they'll look slightly less terrifying.
Is this the same sort of thing with space images as well? Because obviously every time there's a new exoplanet or a new cluster of stars or a new something that's discovered, a black hole, we always see these really dramatic images of what they look like. And it's like, well, nobody actually really knows. We can tell from like some of the chemical compositions because they have certain colours, but I don't know, I assume it's the same with that as well.
Yeah, I imagine there must be similarities. A lot of the stuff that we see from space is false colour. And, you know, it's very low res when you can see it with a telescope. And so you have to sort of extrapolate from that. So I imagine there's some of the same kind of thought processes going on there.
There is a fascinating series to be done on people that have weirdly specific jobs. Paleo artists and people that do artist impressions of exoplanets. Because that must be a job, right?
If you are that, then get in touch.
Get in touch. James@wired.co.uk or @wiredUK on Twitter. Our third story this week, and we're pressed for time, so push on. Ravens. Aren't they cool?
This is me. And
it is you.
Yes, they are. These ravens are the bird that just keep on giving, really. There has been a new study out this week which has been looking at how ravens perceive the world, really. And it's found that they can plan for the future. The birds, which are part of the corvid species, are able to make decisions that will basically make their life better in around, well, anywhere up to around 17 hours' time.
Which is a fairly long period of time if you're a corvid, you'd imagine. So this was behaviour that's only previously ever been known in humans and other great apes. And we could kind of guess that corvids might be this clever because we've had other studies in the past that have shown them to be super smart. But this whole ability to look into the future, it's kind of cool.
It is. So the work actually came from Lund University in Sweden. And basically the way that they worked out that these birds could perceive things and make decisions based on what they think is going to happen next and in the future was they were given a box which had a tube sticking out at the top. And they were also given a series of stones and other items and bits and gubbins, basically. And if they picked up one of these stones with their tiny beaks and dropped it into the tube, then they would get a treat, which is a dog biscuit. And if they dropped the other items in there, they wouldn't get this. So basically they could learn what the right action was, and then when they were put into different scenarios or a different location with the same items and some of them missing and more stones or less stones and less other bits, they would go back to the stone and say, just think, we're going to do this, use it again.
Totally saying it in a bird-like voice. That. So the essence of the first bit of the experiment was they had these variety of objects and a dog biscuit. And in a number of different scenarios, the birds were able to work out how to get the dog biscuit. Then they introduced the element of you could get something better in the future. And that's when the ravens really showed how smart they were.
Yeah, so there was another part of this as well, which involved the ravens bartering for an item, a dog biscuit in this case. So they were given a few different objects, and when they gave one to presented it to a human, they would get a certain reward, and if they presented another one to a human, they would get a better reward. And this was replicated sort of over time, and it was found that they would actually just go for the one that gets them the most, even if they could get something more immediately. So if they could get a dog biscuit for giving you a stone straight away, they would ignore that and hand across this bottle top, I think it was, and get a reward in a little amount of time that's bigger.
So that reminds me of a test that they do with children, don't they? Where they say, you know, you can eat one marshmallow now, or if you wait for 3 minutes or however long they make them wait, then you can have two marshmallows. And children find it really difficult to not just eat the marshmallow.
Yeah, so actually in part of this, they compared the work to that of studies in apes and also in children. And they found that some of these tests, that the ravens were better than four-year-olds or the equivalent tests in four-year-olds. And also they were better than chimpanzees, bonobos, and another type of monkey that I've forgotten.
Macaques.
Oh, how do I always forget the macaques?
No, sorry, orangutans.
Orangutans.
Yeah, wrong ape. So this follows on from one of my favourite raven facts, which is that ravens get paranoid. We reported on this a couple of years ago. In 2016, a study published in Nature Communications found that if you put a peephole near a raven, then the raven will get paranoid that there's something behind that peephole. So it will try and hide its food or behave in a slightly suspect way because it thinks that it's being spied on. And this is quite unusual behaviour for an animal to exhibit because normally animals don't sort of have this ability to think beyond their own mind and into the mind of another creature. So it's able to think, something else might be looking at my food. And then it behaves differently, almost acts to stop it from being found out.
It's a feeling we're all common with, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever I eat, I'm always terrified there's a peephole with another person hiding behind it that's going to steal my dinner.
Steal your dog biscuits.
Steal my dog biscuits. I worked hard for those dog biscuits, damn it. Earlier this week, Wired editor Greg Williams sat down with author Seth Stevens Davidovits to talk about his new book, Everybody Lies, which looks at what the internet can tell us about who we really are. And here's a little clip of their conversation.
So, Seth, welcome to Wired.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
Great. Thanks for being here. So, you've got quite a Wired background in terms of your career. Tell us a little bit about your life before you were the New York Times writer and reporter.
Yeah, so I've done a little bit of everything. I studied philosophy in college, actually. And then I did a PhD in economics. And during my PhD program, I became obsessed with Google search data.
Yeah.
And all the things you could learn about it, just because, I just thought it was, wow, this is like revolutionary for social science, all the information that's now contained in the internet and particularly the searches that people make.
Sure.
So I kind of became obsessed with that. Worked at Google for a while, started writing these New York Times columns, signed the book deal, wrote the book, and have kind of just been doing this for now 5 years, just studying all the things we can learn from Google searches and other internet sources, but mainly Google searches.
So what were you doing? What were you doing at Google?
I was working on the economics team and also the quantitative marketing team.
Okay.
So a lot of data analysis, some advertising, which wasn't my favorite thing, but some other stuff too, which was more exciting.
Sure. So the book it describes itself as a whole new way of studying the mind. How so? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the book's called Everybody Lies, so the idea is that you can't, in general, people can be pretty deceptive in everyday conversation, on social media, they present a front. But they tend to be really, really honest on Google searches, so right. We can see into things that they wouldn't tell anybody else about racial attitudes, sexual preferences, mental health, health in general. So all these areas where, due to sensitivity, people may not be forthcoming normally.
So you think there's a much higher degree of accuracy than, say, when people fill out questionnaires or other kinds of studies?
Yeah, exactly. So if you ask a man, are you gay, in many parts of the world, that's taboo. You're not supposed to. It's people don't want to say that they're gay, so people are going to say no, but they're going to search for gay porn, right?
Right.
So that's kind of an easy way to see the difference between what you might say to a survey and what you would search online. If you ask people, are you going to vote in an election? Everyone says yes, no matter what. They always say, yeah, of course I'm voting. Or did you vote? Yeah, of course. But you can actually see, in the weeks before the election, are they searching how to vote? Are they searching where to vote? Are they looking up polling places? This can be much more accurate to predict who's actually going to show up.
Sure.
Rather than asking them if they're going to show up.
And presumably with things like people not wanting to come out about their sexuality, there's huge kind of regional differences. So if someone's searching in some states in the United States or in some countries, maybe in sub-Saharan Africa, if they have internet access there, they'll have a very different, maybe you'll get a read on that that's very different from the official kind of statistics.
Exactly. So you see huge differences in the gay population according to surveys in different parts of the world, but gay porn searches are pretty similar everywhere, something
right.
like 4-5% in that neighborhood, in Iran and Mississippi and London and all kinds of areas. I mean, there's actually a little bit more of it in places like London, because gay people born in places where it's harder to be gay will then move to
right.
Places where it's easy to be gay, so you do see a little bit higher, but
right.
not that big a difference.
So what other kind of search engines or sort data sources are you using other than Google?
Well, I studied Pornhub data, because I think it's kind of like, where's another area where you're getting revolutionary data? That's sexuality is one area where just the existing data has been so limited, because asking people what you're into is not the best way to find out. People are uncomfortable about that. And I studied a dreams data set. I studied You know, like just all these kind of things that we're learning from the internet. I studied Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
And other data sets as well.
So do you kind of feel that this is going to change the way in which sort of social science is done?
100%. I think the future of social science is studying the internet, studying the data that people are leaving as they go through life, whether it's Facebook or Google. And, you know, in other countries, when you talk about sub-Saharan Africa, where the existing data is really, really lousy, whether it's economic variables or, you know, preferences or anything else. I think it's going to be even more revolutionary because pretty much the whole world's going to be online very shortly.
Sure. And do you consider these kind of new data set you're describing, it's going to offer us much deeper insights than we're going to understand the human condition, maybe in ways that we've never understood it before?
I think we already are. I think, you know, some of the things, you know, in the book that I talk about, I think are changing how we understand it, but yeah, it's only going to get bigger as right. we go down the road.
It's not about the size of the data set, right? It's about the honesty.
That's right. But I mean, one of the studies I talk about in the book, which I think is one of my favorite studies. It's not one I did. It's a study by Microsoft and Columbia researchers where they studied anonymous and de-identified users over time of the Bing search engine. And they studied what causes pancreatic cancer. So you can see when someone gets a pancreatic cancer diagnosis, they're very likely to make a search saying something. It's a pretty big event in your life, right? So you say, just diagnosed pancreatic cancer, what do I do? Something like that. So they say, okay, we know these people got pancreatic cancer. Let's see what symptoms they searched in the run-up to that diagnosis. So let's see what they were searching 2-3 months before they got pancreatic cancer compared to other similar people who never got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And they found these really subtle patterns that if you have indigestion followed by abdominal pain, that's a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. If you have indigestion by itself, that's not a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. And that's like just an amazing pattern. And you think about it, it's like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Like, but doctors didn't even know about this pattern. Like, that's a more advanced way of doing medicine than the current way of doing medicine. It's not like we have a huge sample of users and a time series of their symptoms that we can actually pick up. Like, this is a risk factor, this isn't a risk factor. You know, this followed by this is okay, but this followed by that is not okay. Like, there's all these, like, this rich data that's so much more advanced than the way we've been practicing diagnosing diseases in the past.
Sure. So I guess Google Flu Trends was the most obvious example of a kind of like almost like a predictive data set. Increasingly, are we going to be able to sort of, as you say, look into kind of like medical situations or economic situations? Is this the way that you think that we'll be able to sort of start really having deeper insights into what's next in the world?
100%. I think Google Flu, in some sense, so Google, what they did is they said, okay, if people are searching a lot for, you know, runny nose or whatever, all the flu symptoms, then people probably have a lot of flu in that area, in the area. And they did it for the United States, and they can give the data before the government collects it. There's been some questions. They had to kind of refine the model to make it a little better. But I think in some sense, it's not the best use case. It's a good first use case, but flu in the United States is very well measured.
Hmm.
But that's about as well measured a health outcome as we have flu in the United States. But if you talk about things like STDs or constipation or like all these other areas where migraines, like there's not a measure of how many people have migraines on a given week where we could say, okay, and what causes that, right? Like, is it the weather? What's the seasonal pattern, whatever, yeah. Like that causes all these different health outcomes, yeah.
So presumably there's also in the data set you're looking at, there's also a lot of kind of counterintuitive kind of information coming out of that. Can you give us some examples of maybe some counterintuitive trends that you've seen?
Frequently there is counterintuitive. So I think I've done a lot of research on anxiety and what causes anxiety. And I wanted to see how much anxiety rises after terrorist attacks. And, you know, so I looked at, okay, Google searches for anxiety in the week after a terrorist attack in a country that's been attacked and panic attacks. And, you know, and how does it follow? Like, you know, it should be flat coming up to the terrorist attack. And then what happens 1 week, 2 weeks after, 2 weeks after the terrorist attack? And I found that there wasn't a statistically significant rise, like, which shocked me. Like, how could there not be a rise? And, you know, I think probably, you know, maybe people respond to terrorist attacks less than I thought in getting anxious. And I think anxiety in general, what causes it, we've probably been a little focused on world events. I think there's something nice to say that you're really influenced by world events. You know, in the United States, a lot of people have said they're really, really anxious about Trump and what he's going to do. He's going to Muslim ban and he's going to overrule global warming and, you know, the Paris Treaty. And I think if you look at data on anxiety, there hasn't been a rise in anxiety in liberal parts of the United States during this Trump rise. I think when you look at what people, why people get panic attacks at 3 a.m., it's frequently they're concerned about their jobs or their health or their relationship, not world events as much.
Sure. And can you talk a little bit about the difference maybe in geography when you see, what can you tell about different kind of regions or different countries just from looking at these data sources?
Yeah, so one of the things, again, going on this anxiety, is at least in the United States, there's been this stereotype that urban people are much more anxious, that, you know, people in New York City and just cities in general are much more neurotic and overeducated. And you see that's not true at all, that anxiety throughout the world is much higher in rural areas with lower levels of education. So that kind of changes how we think about where people are anxious. And then, yeah, it's really cool that you can just do different patterns in what people do throughout the world. One of my favorite examples is pregnancy, questions about pregnancy around the world. So in every part of the world, women complain about the same pregnancy symptoms, you know, in similar numbers. They complain about back pain in the similar numbers and headaches in similar numbers. But the questions they have are all over the map. So in the United States, it's can pregnant women eat shrimp or drink coffee? In Britain, it's can pregnant women eat mozzarella or eat pizza? In Nigeria, it's can pregnant women drink cold water? They're all these, you know, so it kind of makes you question, like, where do these rumors come from? Like, that they can be so different. You know, you think that like these are the natural questions, but when you see throughout the world, you see that it's like kind of random what questions women focus their fears and around pregnancy.
So there are dozens of great, fun examples of human nature in the book. It really is great and very interesting and perceptive. Just as a final question, tell us, what's the one thing you learned about human beings that was kind of most surprising to you, or the thing that kind of made you pause?
I think the number one thing that surprised me of all the things I found is that the top search that starts "my husband wants" in the country India is "my husband wants me to breastfeed him." That's definitely surprising, right? I think what really shocked me about that one, and I find really interesting, is after I published the finding, they started interviewing people in India. It's like India, nowhere else. And they started interviewing people, like, you know, what caused this. And they're like, no, this isn't true. Like, it's not true. And I'm like, no. The data is, I know it's true because the data says it's true. So, like, I think you can actually, no matter what people say, no matter what, like, if the data says it's true, then I go with the data at this point. So it's kind of amazing that desire can develop in one country without ever being openly talked about.
Sure. Well, you got to trust the data fundamentally.
Yeah.
Seth, thanks so much for being at the Wired podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Greg.
Thanks to Greg and Seth for that. Now, to finish the show, as is now tradition, a quiz.
Yay.
On Monday, the 17th of July, it is World Emoji Day.
The most important of all the days.
I'm going to start doing quizzes on days after this, I think. Although this is a good day, you know. So, how good is your knowledge of emojis? Fingers on non-existent buzzers, please. What other emoji is based on the ice cream emoji?
The cone.
I didn't know there was an ice cream emoji.
Just an empty cone, that's what I'm going for.
A burrito?
Poop.
Oh.
Oh, I can see the similarity.
So, according to Willem van Lancker, who created 400 of the original 500 Apple emoji characters, some design elements may have been reused between them. So, next time you look at the ice cream emoji and the poop emoji, you'll notice. When were emoji created? I'm looking for a year.
Ooh. I was looking this up earlier, and I couldn't actually, just because I sort of knew it was World Emoji Day.
Naturally.
I think they're quite old, because the emojis we know and love today aren't necessarily sort of, you know, I think they used to look a bit different.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure they originated from Japan.
Yes.
I'm giving you all the facts except
this
for the one
good.
That gets me the
yeah.
point. I don't know.
Someone say a year.
1993.
Ooh.
2000.
You win. You're 1 year off. 1999.
Oh, so close.
That was close, yeah.
So back in 1999, Japanese designer Shigetaka Koita created the first collection of cell phone emoji for the debut of the world's first major mobile internet system, which was called iMode back in 1999. So that's 1-0 to Vicky Turk. You're allowed to get out your phone if anyone's got their phone on them. What's wrong with the clock emoji?
I don't have my phone on me, so I'm doing this from memory. I don't know.
There's no second hand, like the one that does seconds.
I mean, there is no second hand, but that's fine.
I reckon there's no... Is there no minute hand either? One hand.
It has both hands.
Oh, it does have two hands. Has it got the wrong number of numbers?
You're close. Matt Burgess, have a guess.
I don't know anything else about clocks.
Sorry.
I'm going to let Vicky take this one if she's close with, like...
Well, I don't think either of you are close enough. It shows an impossible time. So it shows a time that can't possibly exist. The hour hand is between the 7 and the 8, even though the minute hand shows that it should be at the beginning of the hour.
Ah, so it's like 7.5 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah. It's a time that can't possibly exist. What colour are the eye emojis?
Blue.
Brown.
Green. Oh dear. There's only one other colour. So it's still 1-0 to Vicky. Strong showing this week. What company, final question, what company is referenced in the tiny text on the book emoji?
A company?
Is it a book company or is it just...
I say think obvious.
Apple.
Yes. Oh, you've drawn it. Oh, dear. Yeah, so it's from Apple's The Crazy Ones campaign. It's Think Different advertising campaign of the late 1990s and early 2000s. It's the bit that goes, here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, etc. So if you actually zoom in enough on the book emoji, then you get that little snippet of Apple marketing history.
Is that only in the iOS version, though?
I'm not sure.
You know, emojis appear differently across different operating
systems.
It's
true, and this is a major bugbear of mine. Because it's very difficult to correctly convey an emotion when the face on your phone looks one way, and then when it appears in WhatsApp or on someone else's phone, it looks completely different.
Yeah. I mean, in iOS, you can get the kind of svelte dancing lady, and then if it goes to the Google version, it's their little chubby...
Yeah.
I don't know what you call that thing. Blob thing. Yeah. In a dress.
It's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. It would be like saying a word and it having a completely different meaning to someone else that should be speaking the same language as you. Something to sort out. I've only recently made the leap into emoji, so... I'm struggling.
Only 18 years later.
I know. No, 1999. Yes. Good. Wow, that's really good maths. Brilliant. Have an extra point, you win.
Yes.
No. No, it's a draw. I should really keep tally of who's winning each week, and we could have a league.
We could.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Is that too serious?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, we'll keep it as just a bit of fun. Any suggestions for quiz topics, I'm all ears. james@wires.co.uk or on Twitter, I'm @jtemperton, or if you want to get in touch with Vicky, she is...
Vicky Turk.
Simple. Matt Burgess?
@MattBurgess1.
Ah, the one, the numerical one as well.
Always plagues me.
Always plagues you. And we will see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.